So it's my pleasure now to introduce our next speaker, Annette Hoffman, who comes to us from Cape Town via Berlin. And a quick note, while this you're already looking, I'm sure, at this PowerPoint, that she's asked us not to take photographs of the PowerPoint, and she'll explain. But there's a really kind of fairly significant copyright prohibition on this. So Annette is a senior researcher at the Archive of Culture and Research at the University of Cape Town, and she's currently working on this archive that she's going to speak to us about African prisoners during the First World War in Berlin. And again, as I said earlier, you'll find a very full and extensive and a rather beautiful description of her work in the handout. So I'm just going to get off the stage and allow us to hear from Annette.
Good morning. First of all, I also want to thank Jonathan and Nick and Tamar and Mary for inviting us and for organizing this all so beautifully. Thank you so much. What I'm going to do is I'm going to read an introduction to my material, and then I walk you through some of the archival material that I have on PowerPoint. The problem is, this photograph is not even a problem. That's from a book, and you can take photographs of those. But there are some other images of which I don't have permission to show. So it's going to cause trouble for me if these pictures appear somewhere. All right. I just start reading, I guess. Practices of colonial knowledge production have left enormous collections of written documents, photographs, artifacts, and collections of sound recordings and film that testify to the epistemological and archival practices in which colonized people were assigned the status of objects rather than producers of knowledge. Colonial archives, or the colonial archive, as the entirety of a body of collections that are based on epistemic and political constellations at work in exploring, describing, inventorying, and ruling territories, resources, and subjects, the results of which have seen increased scrutiny and debate in the last decades. Attempts to read the colonial archive against the grain in search for alternative versions of colonial history have been much debated. The entanglement of those archives with coloniality, together with the productive power of colonial practice more generally, complicate alternative readings of the material. Collections of voice recordings that were created with colonized people are part of the colonial archive. But these sound files offer hitherto barely researched sources. Recordings produced by linguists, musicologists, and folklorists preserved acoustic interfaces, which document the converging of distinct forms of knowledge, performative practices, and representation, the dissemination of, for instance, narratives that engage with local histories. In the late 19th century, the introduction of phonography added an audio technology to the available apparatus of the creation of surveys and inventories of native culture. The new technology promised to stabilize hitherto ephemeral sound signals, which could then become storable objects for research. Apart from musicologists, linguists, and ethnologists who recorded songs, music, and languages and folk tales, both at home and abroad, missionaries, travelers, colonial administrators, and traders were equipped by museums and newly established acoustic archives, for instance, the Phonogram Archive in Berlin, to collect recordings in the field. The trust in the exactitude of mechanized recording was complemented by written instructions for the technical use of the phonograph and lists of procedural requirements that were to eliminate the phonographist's predilections in regard of the choices of objects that were recorded. These instructions that were issued for phonographic collecting by German museums resonate with the process of implementing scientific standards and protocols for the creation of acoustic records, the establishment of comparative musicology, as well as the demarcation of Africanistic in Germany as distinct from Orientalist philology. Musicologists and folklorists praised phonography as accurate, independent of interpretive hearing, and the fallible practice of transcription, which was essential for the establishment of comparative musicology as a discipline. Acoustic records resound with the practices and aims of the research for which they were created, which were not confined to music and phonology, but included, for instance, practical challenges of the evangelization of Africa. The interests of researchers can be read in their publications, yet also resound in the specimen they recorded. Practices, interests, and attitudes of recordists often elicited responses of those who were recorded. Acoustic records often speak of the targets of research. A series of words, Lord, God, Chief, in translation, recorded with an easy closer speaker, speaking prisoner of war in Germany, exposes the Africanist Karl Meinhof's concerns with regard to the evangelization of Africa. A recorded series of words spoken by the same prisoner and referred to in a letter focus on the phonology of easy closer, and specifically on the pronunciation of click sounds. Meinhof, who had recorded both series of words as parts, was part of the operation of the Königlich Preußische Phonographische Kommission during World War I. He claimed that the study of African languages was based on the strict inquiry into the sound, into the nature of sounds. The contrast of specific ways to create and conserve knowledge, which the speaker seems to address in his choice of words, Nkwadi and Umkonko, the book and the dance, did not trigger any comment at the time. An isiZulu speaker's question, Nkwadi ayibalichi abelungwana, doesn't the book inform the whiteys? Recorded by a missionary who was commissioned by the Austrian Academy of Science to record specimen of Zulu music in 1908 didn't spark any debate either. These responses or instances of critique were mostly omitted from the written texts, grammars, lexica, description of music, but are conserved in the acoustic sounds, in the acoustic records. Sound recordings register the process of their making. Comments and conversation can be heard both in the specimen and on the margins of the recordings. Together with connected visual and written documentation, acoustic collections provide sources for the investigation of practices that established acoustic evidence. They speak of epistemological constellations at play and of scientific protocols. Colonial sound recordings hold sonic interfaces. While so-called natives were recorded to create knowledge on characteristics of culture, their songs and texts often drew on culturally specific repertoires, poetic discourses, and forms of orally preserved historical knowledge, which then entered the archive. The consideration of the sound archives as an interface of distinct forms of knowledge is related to a post-colonial paradigmatic shift, which altered the position of the colonized subject and allowed for the identification of fragments of non-European knowledges. Archives like the Berlin Phonogram Archive and the Lautarchiv, on which I'm working right now, present archival contact zones in which different epistemic strategies have met and were recorded. The Berlin Lautarchiv holds the recordings of prisoners of World War I, which were produced by the Königlich Preußische Phonographische Kommission between 1915 and 1918. The commission had been initiated by the philologist Wilhelm Dögen and was headed by Karl Stumpf, the director of the Phonogram Archive at the time. Its foundation was a reaction to the opportunity of having foreign prisoners of war in Germany. Setting out to record all languages present in the camps, along with examples of music, the work of the commission was founded by the Prussian state. It included many of the eminent figures of German anthropology, musicology, and linguistics, for instance, Felix von Luschan, Karl Stumpf, Karl Meinhof, and the Orientalist Heinrich Lüders. Between 1915 and 18, more than 2,000 recordings were produced with prisoners of war in camps in Germany. The collection is held today by the Lautarchiv at the Humboldt University in Berlin. The zealous attempt to create an inventorization of the languages of the world, an Stimmenmuseum, a language museum, as Dugin would call it, was not exceptional. It's comparable to George Grierson's attempt to inventorize and describe the languages of British India between 1894 and 1928. It's not an exemption, but it is symptomatic for early German acoustic knowledge production. The procedures meticulously follow the written instruction issued by Luschan and Ackermann, yet they leave out the acoustic tagging, because Dugin had a speaking impairment. So that's a little anecdote. I mean, I read the documentation and the whole archive as a very symptomatic documentation of what was happening at the time. And they followed the instruction really completely to the book. And the only thing they didn't do was have the recordist speak on the recording what he was doing, which was usually done, and was only not done because Dugin was lisping. And Meinhof said that would be completely grotesque if that would be repeated several hundred times. Whereas in recent years, texts written on so-called colonial languages by linguists, such as grammars, dictionaries, descriptions, and collections of narratives, are seen as a significant part of the colonial archive, the recordings that were produced to document languages since the beginning of the last century have seen little scrutiny. Marked by the archival politics that produced the recordings in the first instance, these recordings may touch on a neuralgic point in archiving, since they are the interface of different practices of conservation that become articulated in the double sense of expressing and joining by means of recording. What has been archived as examples of music and languages often holds elements of repertoires, which may be fragments of techniques of record keeping, oral poetry or songs, and narratives that are part of a body of historiology that is orally produced and transmitted histories. This means that the expressivity of the recorded voices and sounds can be listened to along the politics of their productions as linguistic recordings, and the rules and practices of knowledge production may not completely grasp, nor did they always direct, the performativity, generic properties, and meaning of spoken, sung, and played recordings. Contents of various repertoires have entered the sound archives unidentified, simply because these contents were outside of the field of interest in which the researcher and archivists operated. In the case of recordings of the Phonographische Kommission, the double meaning of or performative sense often slipped through the radar of regulation and censorship. Thinking, for instance, the colonial archive together with its acoustic files might therefore unsettle what we hitherto thought we knew about the colonial archive. Taking into account the different technologies and techniques of listening suggests that these had an effect on what was archived and how this was done, but also determine how it was heard and how specific recordings are still assigned to particular areas of knowledge, which could turn, for instance, the recorded voice of an African speaker in a linguistic collection into an asemantic phoné, that is, stripped of its ability to speak anything other than grammatical examples of series of words. At the same time, while listening, one may realize that these historical assignments are not always irrevocable. One of the preliminary outcomes of my engagement with Sound Archive precipitates in the realization that in engaging with acoustic collections, one has to develop a specific kind of listening, one that takes seriously the acoustic object as a document on its own terms. The recordings of the Lautarchiv would not exist without the establishment and operation of the Kommission, which entails that these recordings are not simply voices speaking from the past. Instead, the recordings are mediated voice objects, and mostly not events of free speech or performance. Nor can the content and mode of presentation of stories and songs be divorced from the conditions in which they were produced. Therefore, I suggest that one cannot listen or read the recordings outside of the logic of disciplines to which they were or they are connected. Yet the scientific and archival practices that led to their production and storage do not account for all that can be said and all that was said at times. The recordings of the Loud Archive are also part of a vast fabric or perhaps entangled network of archival objects, photographs, written files, results of anthropometric registration and measurements, reports to the Commission or of the Commission, but also correspondences between researchers that testified the intense research activity in the prisoner of war camps, of a cohort of researchers using the camps as repository of objects, of foreign bodies and languages. Additionally, artists were visiting the camps to create exotic images. In several cases, I found that traces of the prisoners who had been recorded also appear elsewhere, in other files and documents. These multiple traces enhance the understanding of the sonic fragments the recordings represent. These traces also speak to the entanglement of linguistic practices and theories with studies of race that took place in the camps. Although the main focus of interest and activity of the German Phonographische Commission were sound recordings, Luschan and his collaborators Egon von Eichstätt and Otto Reche also produced anthropometric data that were based on the examination, photographing and measuring of prisoners. Now I have a problem. I can't speak in this thing and read at the same time. Is it loud enough if I speak like this? Yeah? For the Königlich Preußische Phonographische Commission, the prisoners, the presence of the prisoners of the Triple Entente, especially of the non-European prisoners, presented an opportunity. Between 1915 and 1918, the Commission produced some 2,000 recordings, of which, for instance, 360 recordings are in 38 African languages. The choice of the languages was not related to the number of speakers of a language present in the camp, but rather to the interest of the researcher, linguists, and anthropologists. Very few photographs exist of the recording situation. This is one of them. And in none of those photographs you get the individual names of the prisoners. We know that the man on the right is Willem Deuben, who was the initiator of the project. The others are called Indian prisoners, so we don't know anything about them specifically, and it's very difficult to connect a specific sound recording to a photograph, for instance. Normally what you get is this. This is the so-called personal file. Personal files were regenerated for each prisoner who was recorded. Most of the recordings with African prisoners of war are acousmetrics, in the sense that the voice recording exists but the speaker is off-screen. Mostly the speakers can be heard and not seen, and much of the information that one finds about him, the speaker, in the files of the Loud Archiv are actually false. Names and places are misspelled, the ethnic labeling speaks more of the assumptions of the recordist than of the identification of the speaker. In the case of the Easy Closer speaker, whose file this is, I have not been able to find more information, but I have worked with the recordings, because his name, the way it is written, doesn't exist. It's not a possible name. So we have been checking or playing around with it, but we couldn't really identify. In other cases, traces of the same prisoner appear in several archives and collections. In the papers of Felix von Luschan, one finds several letters he received from the linguist Karl Meinhof. His description of a recording caught my attention. Meinhof's interpretation of the recording by Abdullah Yen-Yang seems to reverberate German assertions of French and English recruitment politics. And the picture on the right is from Leo Frobenius, the Völker Circus und Pfarrfinder. So Meinhof says that the prisoner said, like a vagrant picking up every cigarette stub he can find on the street, the French are collecting even the last man from West Africa and so on. I guess you have read this. What we find on the recording is this. These are translations of two recordings that I think are related to what Meinhof wrote. It sounds a bit different, but it's probably what Meinhof has referred to. And then in the next recording that I put on here, Abdullahi Nyang speaks about not wanting to be deported to Romania. And I'm going to play this one for you. Play hide and seek. As you can hear, the sound quality is actually quite good. The recordists were really knowing what they were doing. Now, this translation led me to search in the files of Josef Weninger. Josef Weninger was an Austrian anthropologist who did a study in which he measured 100 West Africans. And after I got the translation in which the man says he doesn't want to be deported to Romania, I started looking into these other files, and I found him there. He actually was deported to Romania, and he was measured. And now, finding him in this archive under number 57 enabled me to identify him in Dugan's publication, where he is the man in the lowest row to the right. And in Dugan's publication, he just appears as ein dunkelfarbiger Wolof, which means a dark-colored Wolof. But actually, with the help of the other photograph, I could identify him. And that's him. This portrait is an image of Mohamed Noor that appears in Maria von Tilling's Grammar of Somali of 1925. I have not yet been able to trace who the artist was. But it might have well been produced in the camps. As I said, there were lots of artists going to the camps and producing this portrait, so she might have taken it from there. In his account of how he came to Germany, that appears in the grammar, Mohamed Noor says that he wanted to fight on the German side against the British since they colonized his country. Yet when he was trying to enlist, he was instead interned into the civilian camp in Ruhleben. What he says in the recording is too complicated to recount here. I'm currently working with Bodari Vazame on his recordings. Yet the recordings can be read along his account in von Tilling's Grammar, in which he speaks of being part of an attempt to discredit the Dervish movement in Somalia, and especially Said Mohamed Abdullah Hassan. Interestingly, one of Mohamed Noor's songs is called Ein Spottlied auf den tollen Mullah in the original file, which is a mocking song on the mad mullah. But actually, that was a mocking song on the mad mullah, which was the name the British gave Said Mohamed Abdullah Hassan. Mohamed Noor also appears on this photograph, which shows Karl Meinhof, that's the man with the white beard in the middle, with African prisoners of war. And you can maybe recognize Mohamed Noor from the image. He's the man in the middle there on the left. And then next I found them in a collection of propaganda photographs by a German photographer whom I only know under A. Groß, in the Morris Ettinghausen collection at the archive of the Harvard Law School. Which is, of course, I mean, it's interesting in itself how these images travel. I mean, how these men appear in all these different archives. I mean, you just have to be stubborn enough to find them again and again. But Morris Ettinghausen was, I think he was he was trading with books or something, and he got interned in Ruhleben in a civilian camp, and he collected everything in connection to this camp, and then later gave it to the Harvard Law School. And this was the so-called barrack number 13, which was a barrack that was especially for black, mainly merchant soldiers. But it looks like Mohammed Noor is sitting there, third to the right on the ground. I don't know how much, how am I doing with time? Okay. So I got the life story in a grammar, I got these strange photographs, and I got the recordings, and then you start puzzling stuff together. The translation of the recordings that have so far only been registered as language examples retrieve unexpected fragments of the colonial history of Somalia, but also aspects of a political battle that had been enunciated in poetic forms of speech. In several recordings, Noor is quoting from this political poetic debate between the famous poet Ali Jamal Habil, who was a contemporary of Muhammad Abdullah Hassan, who is seen as the most important poet of his time, that's 1856 to 1920, and was the leader of the Somali Dervish movement. Here I quote from Budari Wasama's description. Budari Wasama is a young historian, a Somali historian who lives in Sweden and who helps me with the recordings. He has been translating, but we also have been searching stuff together because for him it's also really interesting. Budari, a Somali speaker and young historian, has been working on those files recently, and he explains that both men were legendary poets and fierce rivals. The poem that Noor quotes was one of those composed by Habil, in which he accuses Hassan of being an apostate and a ruthless killer of helpless innocents. It contains insulting verses and accusations and mocking. The lines quoted by Noor are a very small fraction of the poem, of the original poem, if there is such a thing. Noor seems to either not know the poem by heart or wants to cherry-pick lines that suits him. He then, after the poetic lines, goes into a verbal attack against Muhammad Abdullah Hassan. The context... I'm actually going to play this for you now. Okay. Without going into much detail, what becomes clear in this example and the other example is that attention to genre, performative strategies, and peculiar modes of employment may alter the meaning of what was initially collected as linguistic objects, with no attention or knowledge of metaphoric content. Because the conservation of acoustic files allows for a revisiting of what has been said or sung, these files allow an altered mode of listening, one that seeks to retrieve what the registration of files omit. This enables the researcher to engage, for instance, with fragments of oral archives that have been ignored so far, but nevertheless have been sonically registered. This interface of different practices of record keeping, discourses and practices that unfold in those files also complicate the notion of narrative agency. Since the poems are polyphonic, the notion of narrative agency or the single voice has to be untied from its congruency with subjective agency and from signifying subjectivity. Narrative agency may well speak beyond or outside the meaning of a speech act that was recorded as a linguistic example, yet it often is intrinsically linked to a polyphonic source of oral repertoire. I think I'll leave it here. Thank you.